I think what I'm going to do is spend probably half the talk just sort of putting some definition to Ali effects, and then what I'll try to do in the latter half of my talk is to put this into some context within biological invasion. So Ali effects, they actually are named after someone. It's named after an ecologist quite some time ago. I think it was around right when Sandy was coming out of graduate school or so. But he studied... He studied animal ecology, and he was really fascinating with animal aggregations. And he was really one of the first to recognize the fact that populations must have some minimum number of individuals to remain viable. And in doing so, he came up with this idea that certain things might cause a population to be driven towards extinction, and that there was some threshold below which this would occur. And some of his, really, what he was really interested in is he was really fascinated with aggregations within the animal kingdom, including humans. He was very interested in how aggregations formed. Some of his initial stuff was done on aquatic species, where he learned that, where he observed that aquatic species was sort of could sort of condition the environment and actually provide some sort of protection from whatever pollutants or so forth were in the water. He's also one of the first people, ecologists, to actually use statistics, which is kind of another contribution. So at the time, you have to put this into context what the general ecological community was thinking. It was really driven by this concept of negative density dependence, whereas when we're all familiar with this concept that at very low population densities, you don't really see a whole lot of intraspecific interference, and until you get large enough numbers, you start dealing with competition, and that's when populations start going down towards a carrying capacity. And what he argued was that it could be a completely different relationship. You could have actually negative population growth rate at very low densities. You still see a carrying capacity effect, but it wasn't just because there weren't any competitors, there wasn't any need to compete with conspecifics, doesn't necessarily mean that the population was going to thrive. And actually, one of his first quantified examples was with an insect, the confused flower beetle, where he put in a dish with the same amount of flour or whatever, different populations of beetles. And what he noticed was, the first thing he noticed was that at very high densities, basically the adults couldn't get enough food, so they started eating the eggs, you know, carrying capacity concept. But what he noticed that when he put one male and one female together, even though they had no problems finding each other, they just didn't seem to produce that many eggs, and he just related to, well, the females weren't stimulated enough. I'm not sure if that's, maybe there's some analogy to human populations, I don't know. But certainly, you know, not having enough potential mates from which to choose didn't seem to get them aroused. So let me talk a little bit about just mechanisms of an Ali effect. And I don't want to be, argue between the groupers and the splitters. I'm just going to be very broad here. The first one has to do with sex. Very interesting concept, I think. Reproduction, how mates find each other in a very vast world. The second one, I have to credit my five-year-old. I had a really hard time coming up with a song that sort of related to eating. And I asked my five-year-old, and he came up with Fruit Salad Yummy Yummy, which is a song by the Wiggles. Those of you who have kids probably know the Wiggles. If you don't buy the CD because you will not get the words out of your head. You'll find yourself singing these songs to yourself when you're driving to work. But certainly another concept of an Ali effect is finding food and also exploiting food resources. And the last one is being attacked or being fed upon by something else. And if you think about, you know, most species, past and present, have been herbivores. Dinosaurs are mostly herbivores. Certainly most of the species alive today are herbivores. So I think it's fair to say that most species have spent or are spending some part of their time dealing with things that want to eat them. So I think this is an important effect as well. So let me start with the reproduction part. And this is actually lifted, completely plagiarized from this book that's coming out on Ali effects in ecology and conservation. But it has to do with mate finding. And if you think about insects, you know, certainly insects have evolved these really complex ways to find each other, but they still have to find each other. They're still very, very small organisms in a very vast area, and often they're in very fragmented habitats. And just finding each other, even something like gypsy moth, which has the males have these great antennae, very plumose, they still got to find females. Everybody got that? You can read it from the book too. And in gypsy moth, it's been documented many, many times by different people over different times in different areas that the probability of a, let me use the laser pointer, the probability of if you took a female and tethered her to a tree and you related whether or not she got mated by the background male moth density, that you would see this kind of effect. You would see very little a chance of getting mated at very low densities, and certainly at high densities you would see pretty much they all got mated. It's not, the alley effect is certainly not restricted to just insects or just to the animal kingdom. There's actually been shown quite a bit in plants and in very specialized systems like fig trees and a very specialized wasp. It's been shown by several people as well. Lekking, which is a type of behavior where males sort of get together, and you know, the birds of paradise are a good example. They do these bizarre mating rituals. It's been shown that the bigger the lek size, the more likely that a female will choose that particular lek, that particular group. Cooperative breeding, another good example where you certainly need more, you need a number of individuals. Bees are a good example. There's quite a bit of interest in colony collapse disorder. Certainly, the more bees you have, the better, you know, the more likely you are to take care of young African wild dog. I'll talk a little bit about these a little bit later. These are like the poster child for species conservation and Ali dynamics. I'll mention them a little bit later, but they certainly do cooperative breeding. Next one, eating. If you've been watching the news, you probably know about the big jellyfish swarm off the coast of Scotland that completely took out I don't know how many millions of dollars worth of salmon from a salmon farm. But certainly jellyfish would be one example of something that certainly does well when feeding in larger groups. So we don't have to go very far from forest entomology to know that there are many examples of bark beetles that are aggressive tree killers. And one of the things they do is they attack these trees en masse with the specific purpose of overwhelming host tree defense. In terms of avoiding being eaten, the concept there is that there's a failure to satisfy predators. And if you think about all the functional responses, type 1, 2, and 3, they all have the same phenomenon, regardless of whether they're linear or nonlinear or sigmoidal, that they do at some point, you know, predators can only eat so much food. At some point, they just can't eat anymore. So certainly low-density populations would be one that would be less likely to satisfy predators. There's also species that sort of work together in groups to detect predators. There's also examples of cooperative anti-predatory behavior. Antelopes have certain pack sizes that where they're more likely to confuse predators if they're in larger groups. One of the really cool example of insect defense is honeybees that thermoball. Basically, if they get a predatory wasp in their hive, that they'll surround the bee, flap their wings feverishly, and basically cook the wasp to death. Certainly, something that would require some number of individuals. And in no way do these effects occur individually. So there are plenty of examples where multiple effects can occur at the same time. African wild dogs are a great example, which is probably why they're on the fast track to extinction. They're obligate cooperative hunters. They hunt in groups, and that's a very important concept of how they hunt. They also cooperatively breed. Not only are they less likely to be successful in smaller hunting packs, but smaller hunting packs, even if they do kill something, are more likely to lose what they've killed through kleptoparasitism. Usually hyenas will come along and sort of push them out of the way and take their kill. And lastly, ideally, some of the pack would stay to guard young. And not being able to do that, you sort of lose your young towards probably hyenas as well. Certainly, examples of that in insects been shown in the monarch butterfly, that if butterflies that are small overwintering groups, they tend to have mating depression in the spring. They're less efficient at diluting predators. And they also have decreased protection from the cold. So once again, an example of multiple mechanisms of the alley effect doing some considerable having some considerable influence on the dynamics of this population. There's also some other mechanisms. Inbreeding depression certainly would be more of an issue in lower density populations, but I'm not going to go into these in too much detail. Environmental conditioning, more geared towards aquatic species that are able to condition the aquatic environment. And the last one's kind of a cool concept, anthropogenic effects. And I anybody's seen the movie The Freshman a long time ago, that would explain the atherogenic effect or atherogenic Lee effect. And in the movie, there's one last Komodo dragon on the Earth, and there's this group of people willing to spend lots of money to be one of this group of people to eat this individual because it's the last one. So the idea is here is that humans put sort of this inflated value on species as they become more rare. They sort of value them as some sort of trophy or so forth. So that's an interesting paper. You can take a look at it, but it's certainly, I'm not going to go into more detail there. So it still brings us back to this concept of the Lee threshold, where that populations below some threshold will be driven towards extinction. If you look at this is just the size of the population, and this is just the size of the population the following year or following time step relative to the initial, and one, of course, would be if the population is just replacing itself, and here's a carrying capacity, but at some point, populations start experiencing negative population growth and are slowly or quickly driven towards extinction. And there's actually been a number of attempts to empirically estimate, and this is certainly not all of them, this is just the ones I sort of grabbed together at one time, and so there's been quite a bit of interest, mostly from a conservation biology perspective, but certainly within invasive species, we've sort of tackled, we've been tackling this concept as well. But there's plenty of examples where they've actually come up with a number, like queen conch, for example, they won't even bother trying to breed in small groups. They won't even bother. So there's certainly many examples in that respect. So Sandy sort of brought up the picture of biological invasion, so I'm going to spend the last bit of my time talking about how Ali effects sort of influence our perspective and management of biological invasions. And I'm not going to go into the different stages, Sandy already did that, but I'm going to focus more on specifically how Ali effects sort of influence or play a pretty important role in both the establishment and spread phases of the biological invasion cycle. We don't have to go too far. We can just look at situations where we've tried to establish something. In this case, this is a really interesting paper by Byrne several decades ago, where they have, here's a case where we're trying to establish these natural enemies. And in each case, it's not too terribly surprising to see that the fewer number of individuals that were released, the less likely that natural enemy population stuck. And so certainly shouldn't surprise anybody in this room. In the same token, we can look at the flip side and look at something like the European spruce bark beetle, which is always coming into the country. Bob Hackett had a really nice paper showing how many times it's been intercepted, and keep in mind from Sandy's graph how little of the freight gets inspected. God knows how many times it's actually been here, been detected, or actually been transported here, but it's never really established itself. And there's several potential Ali effects that could play a role, and Jean-Claude Gregoire from the Free University of Brussels has been doing quite a bit of work on that. Once again, there are one of these organisms that attacks live trees through the aggregation of large numbers, collectively overcoming host tree defenses. And they also have this mass foraging behavior, which Jean-Claude has outlined really, really nicely. And just the fact that they have a tendency to disperse in terms of finding hosts, it really means that the initial founder population site has to be pretty, pretty large, more so than something like gypsy moth, where we've seen outlying infestation started by a car with some egg masses underneath. This would be one that has a very, very strong Ali effect in terms of the founder population size. I sort of put together a really quick model using a pretty simplistic model, just assuming logistic growth, local dispersal, and stochasticity, and I'm also adding in this long distance jumps. And what I did is sort of I varied the strength of the Ali effect. So I'm basically saying there's very, very little Ali effect here, and there's a very, very strong Ali effect here. And this is where you sort of look at this as this is where the population is currently. And I think I did click the mouse here. Oh. Well. Okay, here we go. So you can see if you have you certainly have local dispersal here, but by having these Ali effects, you get a completely different picture of range expansion or spread of a particular organism from a starting point. And you can also see quite a bit of spillover, which is to be surprising, which is not very surprising as well. So certainly, theoretically, this has been shown before. This my simple JPEG builder has been shown quite a bit to play a pretty important role in how organisms spread once they do become established. And we've done some of this in gypsy moth, where we've been able to model the come up with a proxy to represent the alley effect, and also the strength of that alley effect, and then using data from the Gypsy Moth Slow the Spread program, which is a very comprehensive monitoring program, we can relate that proxy for alley effect strength relative to how fast it moved in that particular year. And what we've seen, regardless of different invasion dynamics and different types of susceptible hosts in different areas in which gypsy moth is invading, we get a pretty consistent pattern relating spread. So alley effects are very, very strong. It moves very, very slowly. In some cases, it actually goes back. And Derek Johnson, a colleague of Sandy and myself, we actually took this. Derek took this a step further, and what he did is he noticed that counties quarantined for gypsy moth had a cycle in themselves. And even if you took away some of the political reasons for why we might see cycles, and what he did, he took the lead and saw that if you did both in empirical data as well as a theoretical model. What explained these pulses was an interaction between specifically an alley effect and this concept of stratified diffusion, which is very applicable to a lot of biological invasions. It basically describes local spread as well as long distance spread, whether that's anthropogenically driven or through atmospheric transport mechanisms. It was really the interaction that explained some of these pulses. So, you could argue that the alley effects influence both establishment and spread of invasive species. They can be, you can make arguments that they're dynamic in space and time. And you could also make an argument or deduce that because of this, one important consequence is that you get complete variability in the rate at which species invade, and also the habitats are susceptible to invasion. And in doing so, realizing the importance of alley dynamics, you could probably make an argument that maybe we can exploit some of this concept. And in some regards, we already do. If you think about, back to this theoretical model, if you think about a population being somewhere right up in here, you know, there are a couple ways we can manage that. First of all, we can try to totally eliminate every individual in that population, complete eradication, which anybody who does pest management knows it's very hard to kill every individual. Another idea is to sort of knock it down, knock it below the alley threshold so that extinction occurs just because of an alley effect. And in many respects, this has been shown for gypsy moth. Sandy did a very nice analysis. This is on the West Coast. I always forget if it's Oregon or Washington State, but Washington. I always get those two states mixed up. I'm not sure why. My apologies to anybody from those two states. I guess for those of us in the East Coast, we sort of say, West Coast, it's all in one region. What he showed that, by just killing about 80% of them, that you could eradicate the remaining ones would go extinct on their own. And also Stephanie Whitmire worked as a postdoc with me, showed that in many areas of the U.S., you could get low-density colonies that in most areas would just go away on their own without any kind of management intervention. So that's one way. The other way would be to try to manipulate the alley threshold itself, basically strengthen that effect so that it makes it more difficult for a population, even if it's above the alley threshold number one. By manipulating that, you might see some sort of eradication as well. And in many respects, we already do that as well. Mating disruption is a perfect example, or could be used as an example of how we're manipulating the alley threshold. We do this all the time in many different species. We're not killing anything with the pheromone, but we know it works. We don't quite know why it works, but we know it works in low-density populations. That it does sort of makes it harder for the males to find females, and the populations can be eradicated. Concurrent to this session, there's a whole session on messing around with host plant volatiles. Certainly, that would be another angle where we might be able to manipulate the alley threshold as well. that's, I think, the balance of my time. I'd like to thank my collaborators and, of course, my wonderful technician, Laura. Thanks.